Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is April 15th. We're recording this in Toronto at the Baskin Wealth Management Podcast Studios. We're actually doing a little renovation here, Ernest, starting this summer. So we're going to be moving our podcast room. But I think for our viewers and our listeners, not much will change.
Hopefully not.
No. So we have an exciting show today. We want to cover more about FICO. The shares have been quite volatile, to say the least. If you checked out our last episode, we broke down the reason why we purchased the stock, and we're just have a little more update on it. We're also going to talk about some of our names in our portfolio. We're heading into Q1 earnings season for the markets and starting to get some pretty good results from U.S. financials. So we'll talk about our thoughts on that upcoming. And we've had a few questions about a stock that we sold as well. We'll see what else we can come up with in the next half an hour or so. So if you like this podcast, of course, please subscribe to us on YouTube, on Apple, and on Spotify. Please leave your five-star reviews and your comments. Those things always help and increase our reach and give us the confidence to keep going. In the meantime, of course, Baskin Wealth Management, please check out our website. If you have any interest in our services, want to discuss your portfolio, want to have a quick review of the type of style and strategy that we're doing for our clients and long-term success, we'd love to talk with you. So, Ernest, what a difference a few weeks makes. It looks like we've covered all the losses from the start of the Iran war in the sense of the market coming back. The NASDAQ, I think it's ripped over double digits from the bottom. It looks like all indices are now up for the year. Of course, this is tentative. We're one tweet away or one comment away from more volatility, but it's nice to see markets recover while really the news hasn't improved. And that's really what we focus on, of course, is let's focus on our companies, how they're doing, what they're saying, and with a lens towards the long term instead of trying to react to each and every world event, no matter how serious and important it is. With Q1 earnings coming up, we've already seen U.S. banks report. I didn't hear anybody say that they're worried about uncertainty for the rest of the year. No question there's a lot of things that have happened in terms of the macro, oil and energy prices up, some of these archaic chemicals that you may never heard of. We talked about like sulfur is up like 70% year to date. I thought sulfur, you don't want sulfur because it smells really bad like eggs, but I guess it has some value.
Well, it's not there for you to smell. No, but I think yeah. With the bank earnings, yeah. Banks are always a really interesting company to look at, mm-hmm. for their quarterly earnings because they have to provide an economic update to estimate the amount of loan losses that they're going to have for the year. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're seeing in general is that there is uncertainty and the banks are being understandably cautious, but overall things are still holding up pretty well.
So, I mean, you have all the elements for strong bank results, of course. You have low-ish unemployment. You have
U.S. banks.
U.S. banks. Yes. Both U.S. and Canada, low-ish unemployment.
Canada reports later.
Yeah. You have interest rates that are pretty stable. You have a decent enough economy that's growing. You have lots of demand for capital. There's construction on data centers. There's a lot of building going on. You have, because of the good market, you have more secondaries, new issues, proprietary trading, wealth management. I mean, these are all good elements for the banks. But most importantly, it's the economy stupid and the economy is not leading to a recession at the moment. So, you know, banks, this is the time for when banks can really make hay. So you can, as a result, U.S. banks at or near all-time highs. Canadian banks, of course, doing amazing. One of the theses that you could say is, well, the banks have really changed, Ernest, from being loan companies to really more fee-based businesses.
No, and I think that's what you're seeing, where post-financial crisis, the banks really got out of the more risky lending space and gave that function to the private credit market. And so that's why you're kind of seeing a little bit more distress there, as you know, worries about things like software, AI disruption. I think that's really contributing to the, you know, some of the worries that we've seen in private credit, but not really seeing it pop up for the banks.
So it's, listen, we have no idea what's going to happen next, but it seems like we've moved on from the heightened worries about this Iran war and accelerating or escalation of it. It seems that things are more or less stabilized. We obviously that can change, but the market has moved past that at the moment. It's starting to look forward to Q1 earnings. What are some of the other risks or narratives right now that are in the market that investors should be aware of?
Well, in Canada, I think the big one is going to be trade, because I mean, like whatever happens in Iran, it will probably not be too consequential to Canada in the near term. But it feels like people have forgotten that there is an upcoming renegotiation of CUSMA.
When are they going to sit down or start fighting about that?
So we'll probably see it pretty soon because the official timeline is July, I think, for them to decide whether they want to renew it or not. And so...
Well, I can bet that there's going to be volatility around that.
No, and it's a a very big deal for Canada, where one bank forecast that I looked at said, like in terms of estimating their loan losses, they basically said if there's no deal, if there's no more free trade with the U.S., Canada GDP could fall 10%.
Right? I know.
So it's kind of it's a big deal.
It's
right?
It is a big deal, but. Like that's the absolute bear case, never going to an agreement.
Exactly. Yes.
And we've seen how all these last minute deals, negotiations go, right? They seem to be at complete odds and say terrible things about each other, then somehow make a deal that works somewhat for both, right? And you've seen it over the last number of years with whether it's a war or a conflict, trade or tariffs, God only knows, it seems to be the playbook.
Yeah, I do think that I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I do think we're going to have more on this topic to talk about in the future.
Okay, there you go. So that's some we're previewing some of the things that we'll be talking about in the future, of course. So, I mean, it's a fight, of course, for long-term investors where you have the narrative of the day that absolutely is important, absolutely is meaningful, absolutely can cause problems and lead to new winners and losers, or not, right? Or it's just a short-term temporary issue. How do you discern that as a long-term investor, right? We're all hyper-focused what happened in the last few weeks. Of course, the market confirms it. You're biased when the market starts to go down and you read more things that are negative. But how do you discern if it's really important to the valuation of a company or and when you should be reacting to the macro?
Well, I think that it's something that we pay a lot of attention to when we are looking and doing our research on the stock. It's kind of what are the things that could possibly happen to this company? So if you look at an oil company, I think, for example, you have to consider a wide range of oil prices that are within the realm of possibility. And that's exactly what we did for CNQ, where we said, okay, well, we don't really know what oil prices are going to be. It could be $40 a barrel WTI, or it could be $100 a barrel WTI. We really don't know. But if oil's at $40, then CNQ would make this much cash flow. If oil was $100, then CNQ would make this much cash flow, and you know, just kind of do an expected value calculation as to what type of return we would get.
It always seems that the worst case scenario never plays out.
Right.
Right. It's there always seems to be some kind of offset, whether the market moves on, whether there's a company or industry pivots, whether the market got it wrong with its worries.
No, and I think that's the other thing, which is that you cannot. The world is a very dynamic place. Mm-hmm. And so you can't possibly foresee every single scenario that could happen. So for example, and then even harder than that is that you cannot predict how the stock will react to a specific event. Mm-hmm. So I think, for example, going into the Iran war, if you put a gun to my head and said, do you want to own gold? Mm-hmm. Right? I would have said, yeah. I think gold generally outperforms in times of conflicts and geopolitical conflicts and volatility and those kinds of things.
I would think that would make sense.
Right.
Yeah, as a short-term safe haven.
Right.
Yeah.
But it didn't.
Yeah.
Gold fell during the Iran crisis, right?
And the reason is not because gold isn't a safe haven. The reason is because oil prices went up, commodity input prices have gone up, which makes extracting gold much more expensive, shipping gold much more expensive.
Yeah. And so... I think long story short is that you just don't know exactly how things will react to events, even if you saw them coming.
Yeah.
And so that's why we put a big focus on owning companies that are run by good people, that have a strong competitive advantage in the markets that they're competing in. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Costco is a company that I always like to point to where they do good. Costco is going to do well in good and bad times. Mm-hmm. In good times, they do well because everybody's spending money, right? But in bad times, when consumer unemployment is high, the consumer's stretched, there's inflation or whatever, Costco's still going to benefit because their prices are lower than everybody else. Mm-hmm. So they're going to end up gaining market share over competitors who are not able to do what Costco does.
So if you're listening carefully, of course, Ernest is giving you the elements of what makes a wonderful business.
Right.
And so with our portfolio year to date, obviously we're pleased with the recovery, strong recovery so far in April. Clients should now be all positive year to date. So that's great. And we'll see if we can build upon that. When we're looking at our portfolio holdings, of course, there's still a whole good chunk of companies that haven't done anything for a year or two. And much to our frustration, of course, because the fundamentals of a lot of those companies have been up and to the right, even sometimes better than we've expected. So, you know, we're kind of very excited, I guess, about our portfolio here. I wish we had a bubble with some of our stocks, but we don't, right? We don't, you know, what was this news today where a shoe company is converting to buying
GPUs
to become a data center provider and the stock rips. I don't know if this is a true story or not, but it's indicative, of course, of what happened years ago when companies pivoted to cannabis or AI or
crypto
or internet.
Yeah.
These stupid things happen. There's no bubble in any of our stocks, I don't think.
No, well, certainly not in the price reactions.
No.
But I think one thing on our kind of year-to-date performance, which is that I think depending on the day, we might be down slightly, flat, up slightly, right? But, and we don't manage to quarterly results. Like we're not trying to get the best result we can every single quarter. But I think it was a pretty good result, all things considered, considering we went through the Iran war.
Mm-hmm.
We had kind of a big sell-off in software related, and anything that was somewhat that had the potential to be disrupted by AI.
Anything that's infotech that has some kind of proprietary database has just been beaten up.
Yeah.
Yet there's no evidence of any impact on the results.
And so that has been something that we deliberately look at when we're constructing the portfolio, is that to ensure that we are owning, we're diversified in the sectors that we have.
Yeah.
So we try to own, we do own
some. Well, some people had very bad Q1s, right? If you only owned the high quality capital lights, infotech type names, which have done incredible for you for a very long period of time. But if you only own those type of names in Q1, you got obliterated.
Right.
Yeah. And what saved or helped our portfolio is the idiosyncratic makeup of it, right? We just don't own we own Visas and we own the Microsofts of the world, but we also own Canadian Natural Resources,
right?
Which was up 30%, or Garmin, which was up 30 plus percent, or Live Nation, where, you know, the good news about the new U.S. administration, it doesn't seem to be want to break up any companies on it.
Right.
And we got that right. Or restaurant brands.
Right.
This is one where did nothing for us for 3 years.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the stock is ripping. Yeah. New. Have you tried the new Whopper, by the way?
I have not.
It tastes exactly the same as the old Whopper. Okay.
No. So no. Yeah. And so that's something that we do pay attention to, mm-hmm. and is I think protecting downside in volatile times.
Mm-hmm. And you never know. Like we've been beating this dead horse to a pulp, but you never know when the stock price is going to rip, right? So the examples are Google recovering in 2024, Amazon all of a sudden starting to pick up. Nothing has really changed with these companies. Maybe even the tailwinds are better, but you know, they get forgotten. They're not less interesting. They're less popular. The sector may be roughed up. With our portfolio, we like to buy names that are roughed up. You know, no question, that provides us with the good opportunities to buy great businesses at a more or less depressed price to where it used to be.
No, I think what we are seeing with some of the, in general in the markets, is that the kind of the macro top-down narratives are overwhelming the differences in strategy between companies in a sector.
For sure. So, for sure. And this happens all the time. Right. That's the wall of worry where all of a sudden we worry about the macro. And whatever the company does is irrelevant. It's a stock now and it's going to go down because the market's in flux.
So there was an article about how Americans are eating less pizza.
Yeah.
Right. And so all the pizza related chains, Domino's, Papa John's, Yum Brands, Pizza Hut, they all fell, yeah. Right?
And but, so what was the rationale in the article why people are eating less pizza? But just
it was pointing to, I think the key anecdote in the article was that how many stores Papa John's and Pizza Hut were closing.
Okay.
Right? But the...
Have you had Pizza Hut pizza lately? It's disgusting.
Well, somebody did ask on Twitter
whether
I had stuffed crust Domino's.
Yeah.
And I did. And I do recommend it.
Pizza Hut now is stuffed crust with hot dogs.
Anyway. I saw that.
No, thank you.
Yeah. No, but I think what the article got wrong is that the reason that Papa John's and Pizza Hut are closing stores is because of Domino's.
Yeah.
To be sure, like some of that is going to DoorDash and Uber Eats as well.
For sure.
But Domino's is gaining market share at the expense of those companies because they have lower prices. They have superior technology, they have faster delivery speeds and all those kind of things that are that Domino's does well. And so, but the market is not distinguishing between Domino's, and which is a growing and healthy company that's gaining market share, versus Papa John's and Pizza Hut, which are both of which are just disasters, right? So and that's a pretty common theme across our portfolio. Stryker's another one. Stryker is, I think, healthcare sentiment for healthcare related stocks is just not very good.
We have to remember Stryker, of course, was subject to a hack.
Yes.
They said is going to impact their first quarter earnings, but shouldn't have any material impact for the entire year. And they still expect to meet their guidance.
Right.
But that obviously put some pressure on the stock in the short term. I think they had to stop producing products for a few weeks.
Yes.
Yeah.
But again, Stryker compared to, they are, the reason that we own the stock is because we felt that they had a culture that allowed them to move faster and sell their products better than their competitors, which if you compare Stryker's growth to Zimmer Biomet and Johnson & Johnson, whose orthopedics business is performing so poorly that they have to spin it off.
Yeah.
But the market is not distinguishing between these types of situations, and the stock is trading at, I think, the lowest valuation since 22.
Stryker?
Yes.
The interesting thing about Stryker is such a phenomenal business, in our opinion. Organic sales, 9-10%.
Right. And all volume, not pricing.
Yeah, pricing is actually lower, right?
Yes.
So pattern recognition is very important when you're looking at high quality companies. If they're taking market share away from their competitors, if they're, you know, those are really good keys to strong fundamental performance, hopefully in the future, even if the industry itself isn't growing at the same rates it used to.
And so I think when we see that, it at least it gives me more confidence that when the macro concerns fade, the stock market will be more likely to, you know, like, I think at some point the stock market will recognize the good things that these companies are doing and they'll get a higher valuation.
Meanwhile, we are seeing a lot of innovation, of course, with food recently as a result of maybe people on these weight loss drugs, as well as people drinking less alcohol. You know, you've seen a lot of the food companies make smaller portions or focus more on the protein side. So companies adapt. And that's Coca-Cola, for example, right? You would have thought, oh my God, no one's going to drink all these sugar drinks anymore if everybody's on weight loss drugs. But you still like the taste of Diet Coke or Coke Zero or Sprite Zero.
And they adapted their portfolio.
Exactly.
Where now more than half of their drinks are lower zero sugar and increasingly focused on high protein type products.
Ernest, I have a Coke Zero every single day. So let's talk about FICO because the stock was a recent purchase in our portfolio. And of course, this always happens. As soon as we buy something, it's like we touched a hot plate or something and get burned. But the news on FICO, it's really hard to determine what's material, what's going on, of course. The recent news on the industry space is that its competitor, Vantage, which is owned by the three credit bureaus, has come up with a better score, they say, or improve their credit score, correct?
No, so what they...
No?
No, I mean, just just to put it out there, we bought the stock and it fell 30%, which is not very pleasant. No. But part of that is...
By the way, we're buying more. Yeah, go ahead.
Part of that is because Vantage Score announced some new tools that allows lenders to now, you know, adopt Vantage Score.
And in the securitization market.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, again, like, I don't think this really matters. We bought FICO because we thought it was a great business where the stock price had fallen to a point where it was reasonable. And now that
it's more reasonable.
The market thinks it's more reasonable.
Yeah.
So I think there's not really too much more to analyze
but
about
you can't,
this.
Yeah, and you can't anchor on the certain price that you bought it at. Our goal is when we're buying something, we're looking out 3 to 5 years and looking out to earn double-digit rates of return on our buy price.
Right.
If it goes lower, then we have an opportunity to add more, beef up the position. We never start out with a 5% position with anything anyways, right?
Right.
It's we get conviction, we watch the stock, we learn more about it, we buy more as we get comfortable and as we continue to rebalance client portfolios. So we welcome pullbacks. How else can we build up positions in our portfolios at attractive prices if the stock prices don't fall? That being said, yeah, of course, it optically it looks lousy when you buy something and 2 weeks later it's a lot lower. But why don't you just spend some time in detail as just to reiterate the thesis on FICO so that
So I think the big picture is that I think it's pretty unlikely that they're going to be displaced as the leading provider of consumer scores. Mm-hmm. And that's because they are so deeply integrated into the securitization market and with the lending, driving the lending decisions that are being made at the banks. Mm-hmm. No, I think one of the things that there does seem to be quite a bit of a push by some parts of the industry to adopt Vantage Score. And fair enough, but I think you have to remember that even in the non-conforming market, so mortgages that are not sold to Fannie and Freddie Mac, FICO still has over 90% market share of those, right? And that's because it's because of the relationships that they have and the integration that they have with the securitization players in those respective markets, right? So,
and of course, we've seen that Vantage launch new tools. We haven't seen yet what FICO is going to come right. back with, right? So we're just reacting to the one news item in a vacuum. Maybe FICO improves its scores, does something special to maintain its market share or even increase volume.
Right.
Yeah.
And so one other thing about Vantage that isn't nearly discussed enough is that they talk a lot about being kind of like being a more inclusive score, right? So being able to qualify more borrowers. Mm-hmm. But if you think about this from a bank perspective or an investor perspective, what this means is they're bringing in riskier borrowers, right? And I think you'll see that when it goes to the securitization market, where I expect, and we don't have hard data on this yet, but I expect that Vantage scored paper is going to, require higher interest rates for those borrowers that are scored using that model.
Very interesting.
So if you are a government-sponsored entity like Fannie or Freddie, I think that you really need to consider the potential cost mm-hmm. of allowing these kinds of things. And then lastly, even to the extent that we go from a system where we had one company, FICO, to now we have two scores,
yeah.
FICO and Vantage, I don't think that this is at the current price that FICO shares are trading at. I don't think the market is expecting that FICO is going to be jacking up prices 10 times no. in 5 years anymore.
Well, look, Moody's and S&P Global both traded higher valuations now than FICO.
Right.
Both are in a duopoly business.
Well, maybe not anymore.
With some
anymore,
of their credit ratings. But yes. Yeah, but you get what I'm saying. Yes. It's companies can do fine when there's oligopolies or duopolies.
Right.
If there was a billion different credit scores and it was fungible and no one cared, we wouldn't own FICO.
And so, and there was an interesting thought experiment where, so suppose the FHFA had mandated the use of both Vantage and FICO.
Okay.
Right? There would be no incentive for a price war for Vantage. Like, they would raise prices as well.
For
because
sure. Why not?
Why not? Right? Yeah. So, I think long story short, it's still a great business that is very cash flow generating. They have a good market position in what they do. Mm-hmm. It's still going to grow.
Yeah.
And we're happy buying more.
Yeah. I mean, we can list. It's so easy to list why a stock is under pressure when the stock
right.
price goes down. And you can
Just backfilling narratives.
It's just backfilling narrative. You can say, well, okay, it has some software like qualities to it. So all software stocks are down. Bye-bye. All the other data stocks have been beaten up. The Moody's, the MSCIs of the world, the Reuters, been beaten up. Bye-bye. So FICO's included in that group, right? But the idiosyncratic, the specific business nature of FICO is still a pretty good one and shouldn't be, in my mind, conflated with a software business.
Right.
So, and anyways, I don't think there's anything wrong with software businesses anyways. Talking, just to finish off about the software, we've seen, we have had some fits and starts with some of those software companies, Constellation and Microsoft and Topicus. They're still under pressure, still down material year to date, but hopefully they've found a bottom. One of the big worries about software, Ernest, is the tying it to the worries about private credit at the moment, right?
So, yes.
Let's just explain for our listeners why private credit has a software problem or perceived software problem.
Yeah, so this is more of an issue in the U.S. than in Canada mm-hmm. because in Canada, a lot of the private REITs and the private credit space is really around housing and construction loans and second mortgages and those kinds of things.
Yeah, so you don't want to be there right now. But private credit in the U.S.?
But in the U.S., yeah. a lot of the private credit space is related to, or at least the ones that are in trouble, are related to software-related private equity buyouts that happened in 2020, 2021, 2022 period.
At higher valuations.
High valuations.
With a lot of debt on the balance sheets.
Right.
Yeah.
And the general idea was that private equity firms were buying this very sticky, high margin revenue mm-hmm. That they could use to lever up. They could borrow to lever up
yeah.
and earn a good return mm-hmm. on, right? And that was the thesis at the time. There were quite a few high profile software buyouts. And now, because of the worries of AI, that number one, I think there's been some actual like software companies that are unable to refinance their debts. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, just a general worry about the disruption for these types of businesses is leading to, sell off in the ability of both the debt and the equity of these companies.
That's right. So there may not be anything wrong operationally.
Yes.
But because you loaded up these companies with debt, because you're in private equity land, you're looking for an exit.
Yeah.
Right. You don't hold these companies forever. You look to sell them. And now, of course, the final is what if software companies start losing customers or get disrupted by different competition?
No, it's worth remembering that a software company is not like a building where if you default on your loan, then yeah, you go and take the building and now you have a building, yeah. Right? Software is not, it's just a bunch of code and customers.
Code and people, yeah.
So there's not really a lot of tangible stuff if the business model is broken. Mm-hmm. And so, I think whether or not, to the extent to which that is going to actually happen is a different question, but that's the fear that is impacting the private credit market today.
Exactly. So probably the fears at the moment are unfounded, given operationally most software companies are doing fine or as good as expected. We're not in a recession right now. Yep. The credit is still flowing. I think it's really, with a lot of private credit, it's really just a mismatch of selling illiquid assets to liquid investors in a liquid form. And then having a pullback or a worry and investors saying, hey, I can't get my money out. And so that's a cascading issue. And we've talked about this a lot. Our thinking, our thought process on alternatives is there's a place for them. I'm not sure there's a place for them for retail investors who have portfolios of 10 million or less. I feel like a lot of those customers or clients need the liquidity from their portfolios, need the transparency. But you know, for long-term institutional investors, family offices, those with wads of money, no question that may be an appropriate part of your diversified portfolio.
Right.
Okay, so we talked about FICO. We talked about what's going on with software. One of the things, of course, someone reached out to us and said, why do you guys no longer own CoStar?
Right.
And so CoStar was an investment that we made for clients, Earnest, in 2021, I believe.
Or
2022.
We thought we were smart when we bought it because it fell like a little bit and it's like, oh, we got a chance.
I think
to
the stock was like $110 and it fell to $80.
Yeah.
Even though there was like, this is a company that was producing top line double digit revenue growth of, tremendously for quarter after quarter.
And still doing so.
Yeah. And still doing so. So for those who don't know what we're talking about, CoStar is essentially a provider like similar to FICO and Moody's and MSCI. It has a database of proprietary information about real estate transactions. That it sells to end users. And there's a lot of end users. Housing real estate, commercial real estate is the biggest market in the world.
Right.
Right. So it's an important business and people want that information. The other part of its business, of course, is it's been spending money trying to build this platform to compete against, people know, Realtor, Zillow, right? Yeah. And that's been going, they've been burning money like crazy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think we sold the stock.
About $80 a share in 2024.
Yeah, at least we did something right.
Yeah, or maybe 2025.
It was last year.
It was 25. Last year, okay.
We sold
it. What do you mean
it?
At least we did? So we do lots of things right.
No,
yeah,
but.
Yeah, that was a good trade.
So I think there were a few reasons why we sold the stock. And I think this is kind of an interesting, I think it's a good example of kind of how we think about things and manage the portfolio here. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we had studied TSMC. Mm-hmm. We thought it was a great business.
Taiwan Semiconductor, yep.
The stock had sold off a little bit due to worries about tariffs and those kinds of things, but very, very strong pipeline of growth.
Well, I mean, the thesis was pretty simple. Here's a company trading at 18, 17 times earnings, irreplaceable assets. The demand for AI is off the charts. Taiwan Semi is probably going to grow at high double digits for a number of years.
Right.
And everybody's worried about the big worry is the Taiwan, China retaking over Taiwan, right? And so that put a lid on the stock. Also, AI, is it real? Is it baloney? Is it going to work? And here we are a few years later, I think the stock has gone up tremendously, but the valuation is still the same.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on the one hand, there was a new name that we really liked. Mm-hmm. And the general way we do things is that we don't buy something unless we sell something. Mm-hmm. So that really forces us to evaluate the relative merits of the names in our portfolio. Mm-hmm. I think the reason that we chose CoStar was, there were three reasons. Number one was that they were investing a lot into homes.com, which was a very expensive project. They were spending all the money they were making in their other businesses into homes.com. Mm-hmm. And it was not clear if they were ever going to make money on this project.
They also gave targets and guidance over the years that they did not meet.
Right.
Right. So when we bought homes.com, we're willing to give them management the benefit of the doubt, right? Especially when the core business is running so phenomenally. But when the management keeps pushing back the day that they're going to have profitable or cash flow positive, and the, you know, that questions, you know, what are you guys doing, right?
Right.
It's exactly. All about return on invested capital, yeah. Right? And so how long do you have to wait before you decide to throw in the towel that you're throwing money into the garbage?
And the second reason that we sold CoStar was, now I think people may not believe us given the sell-off, but we were worried about AI.
Yeah.
Because there was a very thoughtful podcast that I had listened to where a venture capitalist was describing the risk that AI represented to marketplace type businesses.
So what is a marketplace type business?
Things like booking.com, like, you know, things where, you know, a user browses something and goes and sees like these are all the different hotels that I can shop at.
Yeah.
And basically like
using a middleman middle.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thesis was that AI took away the most profitable transactions mm-hmm. for these types of marketplaces.
Okay.
Right. And no, you can debate whether that's accurate or not. But we felt at the time that this was a very real risk for their apartments.com business, which is the main profit generator of CoStar. And secondly, in response to Google pivoting themselves to AI, one of the things that apartments.com did really, really well was optimizing their position on search, mm-hmm. so on Google, right? Mm-hmm. And so we felt that Google was slowly going to convert everybody to paid to make up for the loss of search volumes as they transition to AI. Mm-hmm. So lastly, we didn't feel like the management was taking AI seriously at all. Like there were no product releases. Well, they have since then, but they were not saying, oh, we're launching this new AI powered apartment search or anything like that, right? Mm-hmm. It just felt like they weren't looking at it
at
all.
In the meantime, investing in another marketplace, or they made an investment in Australia another marketplace. Yeah. So there
were just a lot of, like, we were no longer as sure about the quality of the business and where things were going relative to how the management was portraying mm-hmm. the business. And then lastly, like, again, like the valuation of the business, even if you assume that homes.com, like they were not losing money on it anymore.
Yeah.
It was still not that cheap, right? Yeah. Especially compared to TSMC.
Okay.
So to us, it was really a no-brainer to swap
at that price. Now that CoStar has fallen in half,
right?
It might be worth another review, of course, because the crown jewel of the business, apartments.com, fine. It could be under pressure. It's still doing tremendous.
Right.
And the proprietary database information is something that I don't think AI can replicate.
Right.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. It looks like it was under activist pressure, and one of the activists, Dan Loeb, just said, I'm giving up here.
Yeah.
Right. So when smart people give up on activism, you have to pay attention. But that doesn't mean anything about the future. The future will be how CoStar delivers the results. That being said, the CEO, Andy Florance, has done a good job historically at the company. So we'll be watching it. But I think at the moment, it's one that we're going to leave off to the side.
And I think this type of environment, because the market is just indiscriminately selling almost everything off, I think you can look for cleaner type of stories mm-hmm. for just really great businesses that are otherwise executing really well, but are just trading at more attractive valuations. And we have a lot of those in our portfolio.
Absolutely. I just listed a number of stocks in our portfolio where the fundamentals are doing great, where they're still haven't done anything for a number of years. And yeah. why do I need to go look for other right. ideas when I know these companies well? And I think they're really just down because of the macro or the market risk, not right. necessarily focusing on what the companies are providing. You're going to Fairfax annual general meeting tomorrow.
Yep.
So we'll certainly cover that one on our next podcast and talk about our position in Fairfax and why we finally joined another Berkshire type clone business.
Yep.
Yeah. So we'll look forward to hearing Ernest's notes on the annual general meeting of Fairfax. And we'll look forward, hopefully, to brighter days ahead for the U.S. markets and Canadian markets. So with that, we'll see you back here real soon. Thank you so much. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.